Welcome to Atlanta Business Radio. I am your host, Lee Cantor, and I am joined in the studio, not with the lovely Amy Otto, but with a worthy substitute, Mr. Steve Ray from Rome, Atlanta. How you doing, Steve?
I'm doing great, Lee. How are you doing?
I am doing okay. Busy day. Got a lot going on. How are you enjoying the summer?
Summer's been fantastic. My three boys are enjoying the great weather and the outdoors. And
are they in camp? Are they old? How old are they?
17, 15, and 14.
Oh, wow.
So just got back from a week at the beach in Englewood, Florida.
And how was that? Is that North Florida?
That's in between Sarasota and Fort Myers.
Okay, so there was no oil problems?
No oil problems. No, we did lots of kayaking and no tarballs. It was a tarball-free zone.
There you go. Now, before we get into the show, why don't you share with our listeners a little bit about what's happening over at Rome, in case they're not familiar?
Well, for those that aren't familiar with Rome, Rome is a business cafe and meeting center, and we cater to a very entrepreneurial crowd, as well as corporations that want to have exceptional off-site meeting facilities and experiences. And we like to say Rome is where you go when you want to have an insanely great work and meeting experience. But Rome is thriving. We were just jam-packed yesterday, and it's just a great place to go when you want to draw energy. If you're a person that likes to work on the move and you don't necessarily shackle yourself to a cubicle, or you don't shackle yourself to a private office, Rome's a place you can go and, you know, interact with a lot of other Atlanta-based entrepreneurs and network, as well as have a great work environment to conduct what we think of as a progressive workday.
Now, is it mostly like solopreneurs, or is it big companies who are maybe based here but they don't have formal offices and they have their people go there?
It's there's a lot of entrepreneurs, sort of less than five employee businesses, but we also get, you know, local businesses like McKesson, which is a major healthcare brand, will come to Rome to have their offsite meetings because they find it to be the amenities there, the way the rooms are outfitted, the plasma screens are better facilities than in many cases they have access to on their own campus, and it's sort of a distraction-free environment for them, and of course the food and coffee is great.
So I've been there quite a few times, and why don't you explain what happens when you enter? It's not a Starbucks by any stretch, but it has coffee and it has sandwiches and lunch stuff like that. And
yeah, we sort of our business model operates in kind of four distinct ways. One is obviously food and beverage. It is a casual fast casual place where you can have lunch and coffee and smoothies and standard fare. We make all our sandwiches fresh every day. They're out of our kitchen. But the other parts of the business model are where, you know, we really take an interesting differentiation. We have rooms that you can rent, so you can come in off the street. You can rent a meeting room, ranging anywhere from $15 an hour to $50 an hour for a room that will hold up to 60 people. You also can become a member. So if you're a member of Rome, it really gives you an interesting room discount package, but also gives you opportunities for you to be part of our newsletters and our communications out to our 4,000 or so email list members. And then we also can advertise your business on our plasma screens that are within the location so that people get to know you and the kind of business that you operate. Beyond that, we also run events. We had a LinkedIn group came and had a social networking event at Rome last night. We have a big event Thursday night where it's really actually three different events coming together, all networking events that, gather a very interesting, very entrepreneurially spirited groups. And Rome is this kind of third place gathering place for, the entrepreneurs that are looking for a very professional but low-cost officing solution.
Now, why don't you talk a little bit about your journey into this? Because you came from a corporate background, right? Like, you were old school.
I did. I was a vice president at IBM, and I was also one of IBM's first teleworkers.
So they trusted you to leave the office?
They trusted me. Yeah, absolutely. They trusted me to leave the office, and, you know, I backed up a truck. They threw a desk and a filing cabinet on it, and I dragged that home and set it up at home, and you set up a phone line. And, you know, at the time, it was kind of an interesting, liberating experience, you know, and, you know, didn't really realize I was trailblazing for, you know, what has become a much more standard way of working. But, you know, what's interesting to me is just looking at the progression of how we think about workspace. It used to be defined as in terms of where your filing cabinet was and where your phone was.
Right.
And now your filing cabinet's on your laptop and your phone is also portable. So the idea that you have this fixed place in which you work,
it seems archaic.
It's archaic, and I think, you know, 10 years from now, you know, we're going to be thinking very differently about the nature of workplace, and I believe that everybody will be teleworking in one way or another, and they will have defined a wide range of places in which they work, not some sort of idea of a cubicle or a fixed office that's their, you know, permanent workspace.
Now, the only real negative I see of having everybody untethered from the office is the kind of the ability to share information quickly amongst the people in the group or the team. Are you finding that as a problem with a lot of these teleworkers?
No, and I would, you know, look, you know, even at IBM, I ran teams of people that were dispersed worldwide. Email was a very effective way to share information. You know, I'm now starting to see the emergence of kind of social networking platforms that are, you know, private branded, be used by companies as a way to disseminate information.
So in real time, because that was one of the negatives is the proximity, like where you're the guy next to you in the cube, you can reach over and go, hey, what do you think of this? You know, you can happen instantly, but now
you'd be surprised how often those two people in the cubes are texting each other as opposed to talking to each other. And, you know, that's one of the things about Rome is, you know, we declare ourselves as a cube-free environment. You know, you'll never see a cube at Rome.
Right.
Rome is about, you know, I have this saying, we're more connected than ever, you know, with things like laptops and cell phones and PDAs and you know, social networking, but we're less connected than ever. In that we've put technology in between human beings in a way that it becomes the interface, and Rome allows you to get back to the, you know, the solid benefits of, you know, good face to face interaction, and
so it kind of combines the best of both worlds.
Absolutely.
So that they're connected through technology anywhere they have to be, but also they're next to somebody. So if they want to chat or brainstorm, that's available.
Exactly. And you see that going on all day long, these sort of impromptu introductions that all of a sudden lead to deals. It's, you know, it's kind of an amazing thing to see how the entrepreneurs are actually getting business from each other and being introduced to accounts. And, you know, there's some amazing, if you just follow the cookie trail of, you know, introductions that got made that were a function of people getting together at Rome and the kind of business value it generated
right.
for those entrepreneurs. Very exciting to see. That to me is the greatest day, seeing people thrive because of the other people they're meeting. And I actually take a lot of time to make sure I am introducing people. When I see sort of a connection in my head,
right.
when I know these two people's businesses, and I go, you know, you guys ought to know each other. And all of a sudden, you know, things start to happen.
Right.
It's really cool.
And so what's in the future?
In the future, you know, we're looking right now to open up two more locations. I think we'll have a minimum of one by the end of the year, possibly two, and really looking at refining the experience to something that can in itself be an entrepreneurial endeavor for somebody that might want to franchise a Rome and open one up in Chicago or wherever. You know, we see this as a concept that is potentially a little ahead of its time.
Right.
But, you know, very quickly when people come in, you know, the sort of instant reaction they have to what Rome is, we just think there's a huge market appeal for it.
Right. All right. Well, that sounds great. And why don't we get to our first guest today? And that will be Mr. Wayne Melnick with Gray, Rust, St. Amand, Moffitt, and Brisky.
You got it right.
There you go.
Good morning, Lee.
So, Wayne, that's a lot of names there. You must be a lawyer or an accountant. Pick one.
Well, you know, there are jokes to be made of those, mm-hmm. and I'll refrain from any of them. But we lovingly refer to the firm as Gray Rust.
Gray Rust, there you go.
Which is probably the best way for everybody to be known.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your firm and what makes you guys special?
Sure. Well, I am trial attorney first and foremost with a specialty in insurance defense litigation. What that means is that my firm and me specifically defend companies and individuals mostly that have insurance to cover them in the case of a claim made against them or a lawsuit filed against them. The question I always get asked when somebody says to me, oh, you're an insurance defense lawyer, you work for an insurance company. No, that's not quite right. There are the occasions that happen where we do get involved with the insurance companies if they themselves are involved in the litigation, if there's an action that the insurance company has to take in filing a lawsuit or defending some kind of lawsuit. But typically what happens is if a company or an individual is sued and they have insurance to cover it, the insurance company that covers the claim or the lawsuit involved calls me, calls someone in my firm, depending on the relationship, and says, we need you to step in and defend the interests of our insured at this point and, you know, be, as my friends lovingly say, you know, wear the white hat and be their champion. And so that's what we do.
And what are your typical clients then?
You know, our typical clients, I don't know necessarily that I can say that we have a typical client anymore. The nature of the business is almost dependent on what kind of policies the insurance companies are writing in any particular day if we're doing insurance defense at that point. If it's a corporation itself that has a self-insured retention or is self-insured in and of itself, then they'll come to us and ask us to defend them. Same thing with an individual. If he gets sued and doesn't have any kind of coverage otherwise, that takes care of it. But if for insurance companies themselves, when they call us in to defend lawsuits, I've defended everything from individuals that have been sued for supposedly slandering their neighbors to multinational corporations that have been sued on fraud and RICO claims. I've defended public and private school districts, churches, and other organizations. So, you know, it really covers the gambit, I can say.
So you gotta see a lot of interesting stuff in terms of both, you know, all the good and bad of human nature. Can you share maybe like without... Obviously,
name names. That's what we know.
what would be one of your more fascinating cases that you defended?
Well, you know, it depends on how you define fascinating. I mean, if you want to talk about salacious, we can go there. But you know, in the past 4 months, I've been involved actually in trying three, maybe four different cases at this point, three of which were wrongful death cases, where somebody said that an individual or a corporation or both were at fault for killing somebody else or at least causing the death of another person. Back in January, we helped defend an individual who owned a apartment complex in Southwest Atlanta. And unfortunately, someone that came onto the property that was visiting a tenant in the property was the victim of an armed robbery that went wrong and ended up getting shot and killed. The mother of the person filed a lawsuit for wrongful death against the individual because he was not incorporated. He was a DBA. And we defended that lawsuit and took it all the way to a jury verdict. Happily, I can say that we got a defense verdict on that case.
Excellent.
You know, recently we were involved with another wrongful death case that involved a rollerblader who was crossing... If you know where the Greenway is in Alpharetta, it's a big park complex that's up off Kimball Ridge Road, just north of the Alpharetta North Point Mall area, was crossing the roadway, disregarded the pedestrian traffic signal that existed there, and unfortunately a car that had the green light that was going through the intersection hit the pedestrian, and he was killed, and so his wife.
It hit the rollerblader?
Hit the rollerblader.
Uh-huh.
And so his widow... brought a wrongful death lawsuit. And
against the car driver?
Against the car right. driver. So despite the fact that the evidence showed that the driver had the green light, that the pedestrian had the don't walk signal, and the pedestrian had the don't walk signal for several seconds before he ever entered into the intersection, this lawsuit, the incident itself happened in 2005. We just finished a jury trial in March of this year. So sometimes the wheels of justice grind a little bit slowly. But those are the kind of things that we get involved with.
But how does something like that get into the courts at all? Like, if it's something that seems obvious, mm-hmm. like, oh, the guy was driving along, green light, and then somebody pops out of the blue, like, it has to take 5 years and go through an entire process like that?
That's one of the things that's worth talking about is you know, a lot of times I get asked questions about, all right, well, what actually happens in a lawsuit? You know, people know a case gets filed and they know a trial happens if there's not a resolution earlier. But the question gets asked to me, well, what happens in between? How does this happen? And like you asked, why does it take so long in some cases? You know, typically, the thing that you've got to remember, Lee, is that in Georgia, anybody can file a lawsuit.
For any reason.
Yeah. I mean, if you've got the $450, I think the new number is based on the new statutes that just came out. If you've got the $450 filing fee, you can go ahead and file a lawsuit against anybody. Doesn't mean that it's meritorious just because it's been filed. And, you know, as long as you plead allegations that are bare bones in and of themselves that could potentially provide for liability against someone, that's going to start the process rolling. And, you know, that person that gets served with a lawsuit then has got to get ready to defend it and go through the process and stages. Not every lawsuit reaches a trial, thank goodness. I mean, you think that the courts are overwhelmed now. I can't even begin to imagine what it would be like.
What percentage go to trial?
If I had to take an estimate, I'd say probably less than 5% of all cases that are filed go to trial. And that's because the vast majority of cases that are filed end up disposed of in one of two ways, for the vast majority of them. There is either a resolution that is reached between the parties in terms of either a settlement or a walk-away dismissal where both sides say, you know, this makes no sense and we're going to get out at this point, or determination of something called summary judgment, which is where the court says, listen, I've looked at everything that's been involved in this case. There really is no dispute upon the facts that we need a jury to consider this case. And when there are undisputed facts and you apply to the law to these facts, one side or the other wins.
So, but in the case of the rollerblader and a car going through a green light, mm-hmm. there, so a judge looks at that and says, well, I'm not clear, like I need more information. That's not a black and white situation.
What had happened in that particular circumstance was that the evidence was somewhat equivocal as to what the lights were at any particular time because of the way the evidence had come out over the course of the case. There were five or six witnesses that had seen parts or all of the incident occur. You know, some people saw the lights, some people saw the car, some people saw the accident. So when there is not an absolute surety of what actually happened, that's what we have juries for. They decide the questions of fact that need to be resolved. You know, if person A says that the light was red and person B says that the light was green, that's not something a court's going to step in and make that right. decision. We leave those decisions to juries. But in the situation where everybody agrees that the facts are what they are, that's when the judge is going to step in and make mm-hmm. those calls.
So part of what we're going to talk about today is liability insurance. Why don't we kind of get into that?
Sure.
Why don't you define some terms like who has liability insurance? Is this just a car thing or
no.
there's liability insurance for your business?
There's absolutely liability insurance for businesses. And your car insurance, since you brought it up, actually is liability insurance also. We typically refer to it as auto insurance as opposed to liability insurance. But if you think about it, it is liability insurance in and of itself. It's mm-hmm. meant to cover you in case you are liable for causing an accident. There are different aspects of different parts of automobile insurance that exist. And if that's something that we want to segue into, we can certainly talk about that. But as far as businesses themselves, businesses typically have two different types of liability insurance associated with them. They typically have what's called a CGL policy or commercial general liability policy. And then they will typically have automobile insurance if they are a business that is involved with transportation
right.
or anything along those lines. And that the whole notion of workers' compensation insurance, which is required by state law, that's an entirely
right.
separate topic in and of itself. And that's not something that I tend to delve into very often. I'm on the liability side of things. But CGL policies or commercial general liability policies are exactly what they sound like. They are meant to cover businesses in the event that the business or its employees for which the business is responsible creates or causes a loss of some kind. You know, I guess a good example I can think of right off my head would be a situation where you've got contractors involved in building a parking lot or building a building, and something goes wrong. Somebody does something incorrectly and causes the project to either be delayed or God forbid, somebody gets hurt during the construction process. That's where the CGL insurance is going to potentially uh-huh. come into play.
Is there an amount that a business should have?
It depends on the nature of the business and what they're dealing with. And the same is true for auto insurance also. If you are a business that is dealing in contracts that are only in, you know, 4 to 5 digits, generally speaking, then you're going to want to have insurance that's going to make sure that it covers what the potential losses are associated with those types of individual contracts. If it is a much bigger business, you're going to want to have much bigger liability limits. I hate to give an answer like it depends in a situation like that. But
I thought lawyers love that answer.
Well,
that's the answer for everything.
It depends. No, on the subject of automobile insurance, it's something that it always surprises me when I talk to people about when they have auto insurance and what their liability limits are, because, you know, we hear those commercials on television where they talk about minimum limits for minimum drivers and things along those lines. In Georgia, a person is only required to have $25,000 in minimum limits insurance. I mean, think about it for a minute. $25,000 is less than what a hospital would charge you for one night in the hospital if somebody got hurt in an accident. And just because you only have $25,000 in insurance doesn't mean that you're not going to be on the hook for the amounts
that,
right, that are above that. You got it. So when people tell me that they've got $25,000 in minimum limits, I always shudder a little bit because the level of exposure they have to themselves is ridiculous. And I'm going to war story for just a quick second, if you don't mind.
Sure.
On that point, we are in the process of defending a case right now, unfortunately, where it was an accident where a woman was killed on the Georgia-Langford Parkway 166 overpass going from 85 north towards Langford Parkway 166.
By a rollerblader?
No, we're not a rollerblader in this case. But unfortunately, it was a car broken down on the side of the road. Someone lost control of their vehicle that they were driving in the lanes. It was dusk. It had just rained. New young driver driving an SUV. I mean, all the possible worst-case scenario elements that you can potentially think of, and he lost control and unfortunately struck the driver that had been stuck and was outside of her car and killed her. You know, if you think about how Georgia values human life, at least what we tell juries to value human life, the value in a wrongful death case is the value of the person's life of the decedent themselves if they had lived. You know, so if that person lived, what would their life have been worth? Is $25,000 going to cover that? Is $1 million going to cover that? You know, those are the questions that you need to start asking yourself when you're deciding, yeah, is it worth paying that extra $50 to $100 to make my limits a little bit higher on my auto insurance? So those are the things that I always invite people to think about when they're talking about setting their limits, at least as far as liability is concerned.
We've become, Wayne, we've become a fairly litigious society. So I guess for you that means
that's good
news.
Job security, right?
You know, just for the layperson, what do you see as some of the top three oversights people are making? I mean, you're kind of hinting at one, but, you know, what are some of the top things that if you could just advise the world, you know, if you just did these three things, you know, you would you'd be protected from 80% of the kinds of cases that I deal with, you know?
It's a very, very good question, Steve. And if I had
to... It really depends, Steve.
You know, in this situation, I think I can actually answer the question without saying it depends. The first thing first and foremost is taking preventative measures. You know, the best way a company can try to secure themselves is to train their employees in the best way possible to make sure that they are taking the steps they need to take and the actions they need to take in order to prevent accidents and losses from happening in the first place. I see case after case after case where I'm thinking to myself, wow, if they had just done X, whatever it is, ahead of time and trained this employee or taken the time to do employee reviews to understand what the strong points and what the weak points of this particular employee was who was involved in this circumstance, this never should or would have happened in the first place. So I think the first thing a company or even a DBA should do is make sure that your people are getting the training they need to do their job and to take the most effective steps in order to maximize safety, whatever it is. The second thing that I would do goes back to the point that we were just talking about, Lee, which is the notion of review whatever insurance you have as a corporation or as an individual and make sure that your limits are sufficient to cover what the expenses potentially could be associated with a loss. And I'm not just talking about automobile situations. You know, as far as businesses are concerned, the businesses need to make sure that they do not have exposure, because an insurance corporation is going to view any particular claim as a cost of doing business. That's what it is. And whether it's – if it's a million-dollar policy that they've got and the claim is worth more than $1 million and the insurance company knows that, there may be a situation where they're going to say, you know, we'll put up our million. But if they're not going to take that, then understand, corporation or individual, you could potentially be on the hook for more than that somewhere down the line. So the second thing that I would say to the corporation is make sure that your limits are sufficient to cover any potential anticipated losses associated with any individualized claim. The third thing that I would say is read the policy and know what you have coverage for. Okay, that's the thing that I find surprising. Having practiced law for well over 15 years, I'm actually coming up on my 20th year at this point, is I'm honestly surprised at how many people don't know the true extent of coverage for what they have. And the vast majority of companies will receive their policies from the insurance company or from the broker whom they're going through, the insurance agency with which they've got the insurance going on there. Here's a good example for you. And this is kind of a what-if situation right now. We're involved in one case where a private corporation decided that they wanted to clear some land that they owned, about 13 acres worth of property, and they took the trees down on the property, got the proper permits from the county, and did everything they were supposed to do, so they thought, with regard to timber clearance. But unfortunately, when you start clearing timber off of land, it's going to change the way that water runoff occurs. And when it rains, and God knows in Georgia, when we hit spring and summer, it's going to rain. When it rains, the water runoff from the property was far more significant than it was previously. It swelled the stream beds that were there, and it caused all kinds of sedimentation, or at least the allegations are that it caused all kinds of sedimentation to downstream ponds and to the structure of some properties later on. Well, most commercial general liability policies, most CGL policies, will contain something called a pollution exclusion. And a pollution exclusion in a CGL policy says we are not going to cover you for losses that occur as a result of pollutants being introduced into the environment. Well, if a pollutant is defined in the policy as any solid that has a tendency to create a situation that is not otherwise expected on there, or whatever the definition is, then all of a sudden that insurance, even though you think I've got CGL insurance, I'm going to be okay, that insurance isn't applicable potentially to that claim. And even though you have whatever the limits of insurance are that would normally cover you, you corporation are suddenly exposed at that point, and it's your personal and corporate assets that are potentially up for grabs. Now, just in that example I gave you, interestingly enough, Georgia hasn't ruled on the question of whether sedimentation is pollution. It's going to be very interesting. There's a federal court in Georgia that has said it is, but none of our state appellate courts have weighed in on that point yet, at least as far as the initial research I've done. But what I'm telling you is the importance of reading your policy and knowing what could potentially be covered and, more importantly, what could potentially not be covered is absolutely critical to any business, be it incorporated or a DBA, to know where the risks lie. But, and so that's the big thing.
Part of the challenges for business people, as I see it based on that example, is that who's your advocate here? Like, you would think your insurance broker is your advocate, but here it comes down to the nitty-gritty, and you need them, and they're looking to weasel their way out of it. And then you need a lawyer, right? Because now you got to need a lawyer to defend yourself from your insurance person to make sure that the insurance person is going to cover what you thought that they were going to cover.
You could feel free to call in that circumstance. first off, understand it's not the insurance broker that's trying to weasel out of anything. And the way it's being looked at is the insurance company is trying to make a determination as to whether the policy that was written and accepted by its insured covers any particular claim that's made in the circumstance. What should the corporation do? In that particular circumstance, you would think the corporation should probably review the policy, make a determination on its own. But if it needs to enlist the help of counsel in that particular circumstance. It's a bit of
But how could they have anticipated? Like, what would have been a better scenario so this never occurred? Like, at the time of the policy, go, oh, we're going to cut down trees, so this is going to affect runoff, and then there's going to be water, and then my insurance company might think that water is pollution, so then...
What you can do in that particular circumstance, and like I said, it was a bit of an extreme example,
right?
But one that's forefront in my mind right now. What you can do in that particular circumstance is before undertaking any large project, and that certainly is a large project,
right.
Timber clearing of 13 acres, but before undertaking any large project, take the time to go over the policy at that point if there is any consideration whatsoever that this might be a problem. And if necessary, speak with corporate counsel at that point and say, we're thinking of doing something like this. Where do you see the potential risks as being on that one? And presumably, a lawyer that's going to know something about that is going to say, all right, understands these are the potential risks that are associated with it. It's one phone call, maybe a little bit of expenditure up front to have the particular circumstance anticipated, but at least they would know what they are dealing with at that point.
Right.
And if the attorney is able to recognize the problem and say, hey, by the way, you need to understand that this could potentially be excluded under a CGL policy, you might want to get in touch with the insurance company and buy a rider to that policy that protects against this particular circumstance for this particular project. And I can think of about four or five different scenarios in cases that I've had where it's gotten into litigation. We've gotten the phone call from an insurance company that said, come in and defend this particular insured because of something that is alleged to have happened against them. And I look at the facts of the situation, and my immediate thought is, God, if they had just called somebody ahead of time before they did this, they could have avoided the entire circumstance in the first place. And I'm not even talking about the insurance coverage issue. I'm just talking about the having gotten themselves into the mess that they are in and getting sued in the first place.
You know, that's an interesting point because a lot of times, you know, the perfect advisor is an attorney. And you practice in a specialty area. And I imagine when you connect with its clients, it's sort of after the bad thing, whatever it is, happened, right? Not before. I guess I had sort of a two-sided question. One is, how can people reach out to you sort of pre-event to get policy advice, you know, as an ongoing thing? And then secondly, after the event, you know, assuming they just have a general attorney, how do they find you? How do they come to you and get that specialty talent that they need to defend a very specific kind of a lawsuit?
Well, the answer to how to find me is easy. I try to make myself as available as possible. You know, you and Lee were talking very early in the interview in the radio show this morning about connectivity and the ability to get a hold of anybody at any particular time. I'm one of those people that has my laptop on me, that carries my iPhone on me. So I'm fairly easy to get a hold of, all things considered. If you want to, I have the, I don't know if you want to call it luck or not, but if you run a Google search for my name, which is Wayne Melnick, my bio for my law firm comes up as the first item that you see on there. So that's easy. Otherwise, my law firm, our website is www.g as in giraffe, R as in Romeo, S as in Stephen, M as in Michael, B as in Bravo, grsmb.com. If you click on attorneys, my name, my phone number, my email address comes up. If anybody wants to reach me, my direct line is 404-870-7385. That's a direct line to my desk that bypasses any of the receptionists. And if I'm not in, leave a voicemail. I'm very good about getting back to who I need to get back to. The question is, but why would you think to seek out an attorney, if I'm understanding the question correctly?
Well, let's just say, you know, somebody at Rome tripped on a power cord, you know, broke their nose. They want to sue us
not
for $1 million.
Not that would ever happen.
And not that that would ever happen, exactly. But, you know, now I'm in this situation, and, you know, we've got an attorney, right? But he's not necessarily specialty in this area. What gets me to you? Right.
Would you be able to like kind of go into his place and go, you know what, this could be an area you may want to check out, like preemptively? What work can he do to prevent things from happening?
That's certainly one thing that an attorney can help with on that point. Like you said, a lot of what I do is get involved after the fact. where I'm saying to the person, God, I wish you had called ahead of time, and we could have dealt with something like that.
Told you so.
But would you have been, you wouldn't have been the right resource ahead of time, would you have been?
Possibly. I mean, a lot of the negligence law that you're talking about, and that's more what we call premises liability negligence law, a lot of that is actually common sense. And the more experienced I've gotten over the years, the more I deal with things, the more I'm pleasantly surprised to see that the law actually does deal in common sense. You shouldn't have had that wire running across that main hallway in your front entrance in the first place.
We took it down.
Well, I'm glad that you all did that because that would have been a potential problem. Is an attorney the right resource for doing something like that? Possibly. On something like that. It just is, it depends on the nature of the hazard in question that you're talking about. If you're worried about, are our premises safe, generally speaking, then yeah, maybe it is an attorney that you want to have involved with a particular circumstance like that, especially when you are opening a new business at that point. Maybe it's an engineer that you want to talk to, and the person who designed the premises in the first place, that did the build out for you. Those are the people. Maybe you want to do that final walkthrough with them and have those things looked at and taken care of ahead of time. But in the circumstance you're talking about, which is where a bad thing has already happened at that point, and we have a corporate attorney at that point, but maybe not someone who is involved directly in the notion of defending claims based in negligence or in premises liability, there's different reasons you might want to reach out. If you have CGL insurance or there's an applicable insurance that the corporation has, what's going to happen is you're going to report the claim, obviously, to the insurance company. And if necessary, the insurance company is going to assign defense counsel. Maybe me, maybe somebody else, depends on if the insurance company is one of the companies I deal with. But what you may want is you may want an independent counsel watching over the litigation, watching over the development of the claim and how it goes, to make sure that the interests are being protected and that things are being done the way they are supposed to do. And when the opportunity presents itself for, a resolution of the circumstance, if you think as a business, you know what the person is asking for is reasonable, I really think the insurance company should take them up on this offer or at least involve in negotiations at that point to try to reach a resolution to this matter. Maybe that independent counsel is the hammer that you need to the anvil to be able to say to whomever the insurer is, you need to get this resolved because you as an insurance company are required to place the interests of your insured over the interests of the insurance company. And that's where we can help. If we're not being called in to defend an insurance claim by an insurance company for a corporation, that's where someone like me can come in and help a corporation resolve an unfortunate situation that might otherwise be dragged on longer than it should be. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff, Wayne. Now, give your website one more time.
Sure. The law firm, which is Gray, Rust, St. Amand, Moffitt, and Brisky, we can be found on the web at www.grsmb.com. If you're looking for me specifically, again, my name is Wayne Melnick, and if you go to the GRSMB website, you can click on the link for attorneys and find my name there, and all of my information is available, and look forward to hearing from anybody.
Good stuff. Next up, we got Vanessa Lowry with Connect for Leverage. Vanessa, welcome to the show.
Lee, it's great to be here with you all again.
I hear, rumor has it, there's a big fun run happening again for, what is this year? What are we on, five?
This is year five. This is the fifth annual Roswell Tree. We're in competition to that little race that happens on the 4th of July called the Peach Tree, which we lovingly call the Peach Shrub.
Right.
But we start later, we have more fun, and everybody wins our race. So this year we're on track to have about 100 people, where the Peach Tree is 55,000 people all smushed together. We have 100 people, and everybody has fun, and we have breakfast after the race. So,
and where does this take place?
It takes place at Roswell Park in downtown Roswell, the park that's off of Woodstock Road. And Lee, we're happy that you're coming again this year. I know last year you came with your with your family and your dad, too. We're a great family-friendly event, so It's great to have you coming again.
Absolutely. Why don't you talk a little bit about the history, how it got started, and what made you go head-to-head, and how's the Peach Tree reacting to this?
Yeah, I'm happy to. My friend Sally Jamara is actually the original founder of the race, and now I am co-founder with her. But the first year, Sally did the race on her own. She had a number to the peach tree, and it was so far back that she decided she was not going to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go down and wait for 3 hours before she even crossed the start line. So she decided to do her own 10K at Roswell Park, which is very close to her house. And I met her for breakfast afterwards. And so when she walked in, I said, "How did you do?" And she said, "I won." And I just thought that was great. So we decided that the next year I wanted to win, and we ended up getting some friends to run with us. And so the Roswell tree was kind of born from that. We've got a great little history page on our website, which is roswelltree.org, that gives a little more information. But we just have had a great time with it and love getting people together. We've actually made it a fundraiser for the food bank. We figure with our slogan, Running for Breakfast, tying into the food bank is actually a very natural, a natural thing. And the food bank has been a client of mine for about 16, 17 years now. So it's great to be able to support them with the benefits, the proceeds from the race. We have great sponsors, including Atlanta Business Radio, that cover the cost that's associated with the race. And then all of the proceeds from the entries actually go directly to the food bank. So,
and then explain how everybody wins. Like, what divisions are there? Like, because, you know, there's usually the age divisions, but how does yours work?
Well, ours is very different. We have a very unique model for our race. Everybody gets to pick their own division. But Sally and I, as the committee, want this to be really fun. So if people give us a division that we don't like, we make up a fun division for them. So we make a really cool certificate with their name and their division, so they win their division. They are required to cross the finish line. They are not required to do the whole 10K. But the way that the course is set up, the finish line and the start line are actually the same line. So one step is
completing the race.
That's right. One step will do it for you. So we do have, you know, we do have very elite runners that run the whole 10K. We have people that walk or stroll part of the course, and we have people that just cross the finish line and set and cheer for everybody that comes in. So we did, every year we kind of institute a new rule. And last year we had a new rule that everyone had to celebrate when they came across the finish line. And Lee, your crew did a great job celebrating.
But we didn't win best celebration.
No, you know, we had Santa there that was... We're lucky to have Santa at our race, and he was judging the celebrations as people came across, and I'm sorry that you all didn't do it, but we had some amazing celebrations. So I hope you're working on a good one for this year so that we can, you know, maybe give you a winning category in that celebration category as well.
And breakfast this year, is it always in the same place?
You know, in the past, we have done breakfast at J. Christopher's. J. Christopher's is one of our sponsors. And this year we've really outgrown their facility. They've got a number of facilities, but we've just outgrown how much space that we can take inside one of their standalone stores. So we're actually catering breakfast into the park. So it makes it even easier for people to have breakfast and stay with us after the race. And J. Christopher's is still a sponsor. We've got several different levels of sponsorship. And I've got kind of a fun story. Two of our red level sponsors, which are our top sponsors, are J. Christopher's and Dr. Cedric Noel, who is a chiropractor. And both of them have been sponsors of the race. This is their third year. J. Christopher's has actually been involved in the race from the beginning, since Sally and I meet for breakfast at J. Christopher's and do a lot of planning for the race at J. Christopher's. But Dr. Cedric Noel is getting married the week after the race this year, and he had his first date with his fiance at J. Christopher's. So how perfect is that?
Wow. And you got
that is some dedicated sponsors we have there.
Dr. Noel and Santa in the same race.
I know. I know. How perfect is that? Yeah. Yeah, we're very careful. We're very selective about our sponsors and about the people that are admitted into the race. People actually have to apply to the committee, and we have to designate that they are fun enough to be in the race. So we're very excited this year that we have a whole family that have applied to be in the race that we've gratefully accepted. That's about 8 to 10 people now that are a variety of ages, I believe, and we're excited to see them all come to the race, and they've designated all of their certificates as the mighty something something. So it's, you know, it's fun that people are kind of getting the flavor of it and playing with us, that they're enjoying the fun of the race.
So as you're going up against the peach tree, I mean, you have the proximity factor for people in Roswell. And how do you get the word out to people? I mean, I know you're on the radio, but what are some other ways in which you get the word out and build this community event?
You know, we do it a couple of different ways. We use a lot of social media, so, you know, that's a great platform to sharing the word and letting people be able to share the information with the people they're connected with. We also count on our sponsors to help get the word out. So we give a lot of our sponsors applications. We send all of them PDF applications so that they can share it. We've had a number of sponsors included in their monthly newsletters that go out. We're very grateful to be on Atlanta Business Radio. We also this year sent out some press releases and had an article in the Roswell Current. So we've gotten a number of people. I think this family of about 10 people all came from that article in the Roswell Current. So, like I said, we're on track for about 100 people this year. We've got a few spaces left for fun people. So we would love additional people that are interested in the race to join us this year. Our deadline is Friday because we do have to do the certificate. So we have to make sure that we've...
Right, the personalized certificate. It's not like
That's
a generic...
Right. Suitable for framing.
Exactly. You know.
So do they block off all the streets around Roswell for the race? Or
no, it actually takes place in Roswell Park. So
okay.
We do several loops in the park.
Do loops in the park.
But it's great because there's lots of trees. It's shaded. For people that have kids, there's actually a couple of playgrounds that are on the course so the kids can stop and play, which we've had that happen a number of times. And like I said, you know, people can do the whole race or they can just loop once and stop and cheer and come by the water station and have water. One of the great things about the race, since we do benefit the food bank is one of those organizations that really is stellar in the way that they use their money. And because of the way they're able to leverage dollars, every single dollar that they get, this year they were able to leverage almost $8 worth of groceries. So last year we raised $2,500, which then they could leverage to an additional $8 for every dollar. So, you know, that really feeds a lot of people that have, this has been a huge year of struggle for a lot of people. And the food bank has increased their food that they're distributing by about 40%. So the need is great. And they had almost £29 million of food that they distributed in this past year. It's been a really tough year for a lot of people. So doing things to benefit them and helping our neighbors is huge. And we have fun too. You know, it's great when you can have fun and help other people
right.
at the same time.
I think it's a great story that it started as just kind of on a whim, and now here it is year after year getting larger and larger and helping more and more people. So
that's a
great story, Vanessa. Thank you so much for being here. And again, the website?
It's roswelltree.org. And Sally and I are really excited to be part of the race again, and we would love for some fun people to come be part of it with us. So,
and are you on? You're on Facebook. You're everywhere, right? All the social media they can find it.
We don't actually have a Roswell Tree website on Facebook, but Vanessa Lowry, I'm on Facebook. So,
right. And I saw an invitation on the Facebook page.
Yes, we do have an invitation event on Facebook. We also have an event on LinkedIn, so you can search for Roswell Tree both on Facebook and LinkedIn and find the event. But we'd love to have, you know, some fun people that really get the quirkiness of the race and want to be part of it.
Good stuff.
Great.
Steve, great show. Thank you so much. Why don't you give your website for Rome Atlanta? Because you guys have events, two or three times a week,
time,
right?
And they're listed in the What's Happening part of our website. But our website address is romeatlanta.com.
And then,
and that's R-O-A-M, by the way, as opposed to
Rome, Georgia.
Right.
And are there any events coming up the next week or so?
We have a gathering on Thursday night, tomorrow night. There'll be a number of events there tomorrow night. Everyone's welcome. It's an open house. So if you're interested in anything from Photoshop to business networking, it'll be a good opportunity for you to get to meet other Romers and also maybe learn a few interesting things.
Good stuff. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening. This has been another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. See you next time.